And you don't need that.
Nah, that's okay. Only if it's worth something. Yeah. My name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here at the lake tonight. Abe mentioned that I was over at Lake Byrd, and that was in 1989. And my sobriety date is May 18th, 2008. So I picked up more than one white chip. But I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be amongst friends. I know a lot of people here, and it's just such a wonderful place to be. And thank you to the committee and to everyone for your gracious invitation. And I'm honored to speak at an AA meeting, but in particular to speak here tonight. So hopefully you get something out of my message. I know before I started, they said, you know, are you a little nervous or something, you know? And I was like, yeah, a little bit, you know, but I'm glad that it's going to get over on Friday night so I can enjoy the weekend. So I always like to say I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know what I mean? And I don't know, my name's Matt, I'm an alcoholic, I think I said that. And what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. You know, I, like you guys, don't remember, you know, 8 years old in my New York Giant pajamas, listening to the game in my room, thinking, boy, when I grow up, I don't want to be a fireman, astronaut, I want to be an alcoholic. You know, that's just not something I was planning on doing. And I really didn't know I came from a dysfunctional family till I came to AA. You know, where I grew up, you know, basically my family was a little bit eccentric, but not unlike a lot of people in the neighborhood. You know, a little loud at times. But you know, I grew up, and my dad was an architect. My grandfather owned a construction company, so they entertained a lot. You know, and up north they got basements and they finish them off, and you know, some of them look like Studio 54, you know, and they really do a good job. And back in the day, and you mix in a pool table, and, you know, you got your own little Nirvana up there, you know, and beats the winner. And that's where I did my drinking, in basements up north. That's where I started. And my story starts pretty young. You know, I was doing okay, and those guys were entertaining their clients, and it looked like a lot of fun, you know. And I thought that's kind of how you had fun. You know, I could see that my dad in particular loosened up quite a bit when he had a few pops in him, you know. So I didn't mind if he was, you know, had a beer in his hand once in a while, and he was easy to clip a few dollars off of in that condition, you know. And I learned early. And so what happened, though, is looked like a lot of fun. And I started drinking when I was about 12 or 13 years old. I picked up a drink, and for me anyway, I drank alcoholically from the beginning. So I went to a party and we drank, and I woke up the next day, I was covered in mud, I was in my basement, my buddies had spent the night, and I had fell into a water hazard on a golf course, you know what I mean? On the way home, apparently walking through the golf course was like the Lewis and Clark expedition for me, you know, coming back from this party, you know, that I'd been through that neighborhood quite a bit, you know. So, but that should have been a sign there. But all that meant was I can't wait to do this again, you know. And I was a young kid. And what happened, though, is the weekends started to mix into, you know, maybe Thursday or Wednesday. And I started, you know, I smoked pot and as well. And I was a pretty good student. I was actually a pretty good athlete in particular, too. And our sports teams weren't that good, so I don't know how good I was or how bad we were. But I did play a lot of sports when I was a kid. And so what happened is it started becoming a problem for me when I was like 15, 16 years old. And at that point, my parents had split up, and my dad was an alcoholic and drinking and behaving alcoholically, and that was the cause of that. And quite frankly, I didn't really care because he was pretty, you know, strict. You know, I kind of had to report topside at 0800, you know, and that kind of thing. And for a guy like me, that wasn't too cool, you know, on a Saturday morning. And so when he left, things loosened up around the house, and I kind of did my thing, and It wasn't too far after that, you know, my behavior started to kind of catch up with me. And everybody was understood I was a little crazy and I liked to have a good time. And it was the 70s, and that's what you did. But one time in particular, we skipped school, and we went out, and we got a keg, and we went into the wooded area near my high school, and we drank. And I was a good wrestler, and my wrestling coach used to say, you know, he wasn't dumb, you know, back in the day, you know, and he'd say, look, keep an eye on Matt, okay? Somebody's got to keep an eye on Matt. Make sure to get him home, you know, and make sure you see him go in his house, okay? So is that, you understand that? Okay, yeah, we understand that. So they asked him the next day, you know, what had happened is I went home, and not unlike any other time, I went home and went in the house and fell asleep on the couch. Unfortunately, in this case, it wasn't my house or my couch. And it was a lady down the street from where I live who wasn't that enamored with me anyway, you know? So it's kind of serious. I mean, you know, it's, you know, when you're entering an occupied dwelling, I mean, you know, stuff like that, right? And I wouldn't have held up too good in Attica. So that got my attention. And so the lady wanted to press charges and, you know, this guy's no good, bop, bop, bop. And so they went in front of the judge. And I remember before I went, my coach was mad and they said, how come you didn't keep an eye on him? How come you didn't keep an eye on him? And they said, I don't understand, coach. He was leaning out a cab puking and we sent him home and paid the cab driver. So I don't know how this could have happened. So, but that's what happened. And I went in front of a judge at the ripe old age of 17. And I'd already been put on 3 years probation for another legal misunderstanding a couple years ago. So here I was again in front of this guy, and he looked at me, and he looked at my record, and he brought in, and they said, look at his SAT scores. He's going away to college, and he's going to wrestle up there. And he said, the judge said, this kid's not a criminal. He's an alcoholic. And they said 90 meetings in 90 days. And I was sentenced to 90 meetings in 90 days in White Plains, New York. And that was my introduction into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. And they didn't send 17-year-old kids to AA in 1979. So back then, I remember, somebody mentioned to me, it might have been my designated sponsor, the judge pointed me out to, and he said, these guys are going to ask you a lot of questions when they pick you up to bring you to a meeting. You know, they're probably not going to be too, they're going to think you're a juvenile delinquent, not an alcoholic. And they picked me up, and that's what they did. There was old Joe, God bless him, he's in AA meeting upstairs. He was, you know, 70 when he picked me up for the meeting. And he was from Brooklyn, and he moved to Westchester County in a cowboy hat and a belt buckle, and he retired. He thought he went to Wyoming, okay? So he was up there, he picked me up, and these guys in like a Lincoln Town Car, and they asked me a bunch of questions, and I said, you know, I don't mind your own business. I don't remember what I do when I drink. I don't belong here. Bop, bop, bop. And they had me tell them my story a little bit, and they said, welcome to AA. About 5 minutes later, okay, they were convinced I was one of them, and they took a guy who was a Vietnam vet back then, a kid, he was probably in his late 20s and in the 70s, and and they said, you're going to be his sponsor, and because drugs were in his story. And off we went to AA. And I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Now, I drank in between because I didn't know that you weren't supposed to do that. And also, you know, I was just trying to kind of, you know, complete a legal requirement, okay? I mean, that no drinking thing was just a little too radical, I thought, you know? But I did identify at my first AA meeting as an alcoholic. They talked about blackout drinking and getting in trouble, and I knew all about that. And they also said that you can stop, and this can be it right now, and, you know, because you're an alcoholic. They took my inventory. Back then, that's what they did. you know? And so back then, they didn't let new guys speak either. That if you were counting days, they asked if you were counting days. And then you say, my name's Matt, I'm counting days, I got 42. I was born in a log cabin in Westchester County. Whoa. You don't worry about it, Matt, welcome, you know. Hopefully you can use something here tonight, talk to somebody after the meeting, okay? So they kind of cut you off, and after 90 days, they give you a pin back in the day. And I remember I got up, and they let you speak for 10 minutes. And I got up, and I got my pin, and I thanked the dais and everybody and said, you know, my name's Matt, I'm an alcoholic, and I'll see you in about 40 years. And I won't tell you what they said to me. It was a men's meeting, but it's anatomically impossible, okay? So off I went, okay, with a head full of AA, with all the knowledge, by the way, of being absolutely an alcoholic. I knew about alcoholics and alcoholic drinking. You know, you shake my family tree and empties fall out, okay? So the thing is, my dad was a full-blown alcoholic. My grandfather died, they all died from pneumonia, the flu or something, but they all died from alcoholism, right? So he died in early age, and he loved me to death. He was actually an Italian guy. You never heard of an Italian guy drinking iced tea, okay? But apparently he liked iced tea, and I could never touch his iced tea. And it looked a lot like McCallum 18 later on, you know, scotch, right? And that's why I think he was drinking all that time. So God rest his soul. So I went to my 90 and 90, you know what I mean? I got freed from the judicial system, and then I was on my way. And I remember I was going away to college, and I was in a pre-law program, you know, not because I wanted to argue in front of the Supreme Court, because with my juvenile record, I thought I could put myself on retainer, you know what I mean? And I knew a little bit about the legal system anyway. So I went to school, and with all the wisdom of a 17-year-old boy or 18-year-old kid, I came up with my own recovery program. I was only going to drink beer and eat acid, okay? And I was going to drink beer because beer doesn't really count, we know that. And then LSD, well, you know, I am in college and I need to expand my mind. So that's what I did. And I came out of a blackout one night. And I remember the next day, and this was October, school starts September 1st, you know, Halloween time, I came out of a blackout. And I remember like it was yesterday, I went by the student union and there was a triangle on the student union, the A sign, and it was a young person's meeting. And for a minute, I actually considered, you know, checking it out. But that was it. And then at that point, things just continued to start to get worse for me. And what had happened is I got caught plagiarizing in school. And my professor is a chairman of the political science department. So listen, I don't know why you did that. You participate in class and everything else. And, you know, I did it because I needed to do it because I was partying and having a good time. And he said, you got to, I'm not going to kick you out of school, but you got to change your major. And so that's what I did. And I don't know whether I graduated with you know, because I merited the degree, or they just kicked me out to get me out of school, you know. And so what I did, like any other kid, I had a restraining order against me. I was the only kid, I think, probably at my commencement. My family didn't show up. My mother had told me, she was in a tough love group at this point, and she said, your brother worships you, your younger brother. You're a maniac. I don't want him to end up like you. Don't come home. I don't care if, you know, you graduate, with honors, you're not coming here. And so what I did is I did I made an unusual decision. A lot of people from up north, I decided to come to Florida. So I came down here because that would help my drinking problem. And I came down to Florida, and I had some friends down here that had graduated before me. And then things got really out of hand down here. I'm an alcoholic, but I was down here, and about a half hour later, I picked up a bad cocaine problem, you know, and what had happened is I wound up, had a good job, and I came out of a blackout 2 years later, and I was in a suit. I had one shoe, and I was walking down Dixie Highway near the 101 Club, and I knew that the 101 Club was an AA place. And I went in because it was raining, and they took one look at me, and they brought me down to BARC, which at the time was Broward Alcohol Rehabilitation Center. So I went down to BARC, and they admitted me. I stayed there for 5 days, and I got out. Now, I had never really been without a substance in my body for 5 days since I was that 12-year-old kid. You know, I went to the 90 and 90, but I drank in between and everything else. And they asked me, where do you want to go? You know, we'll give you a ride somewhere, you know. And I said, I'll go to the 101 Club. So I had the suit, I had the one shoe, and I think I had a flip-flop, right? They gave me a flip-flop, so I was dressed to kill. So what happens is I go into the clubhouse over there, and I sit down, and back then they had the newspaper for wanted ads. So I had cash flow issues at the time, so I was going to consider some sort of gainful employment, and I was looking at the newspaper, and the guy came up to me, and he said, they're hiring at the machine shop around the corner. You know, you're a little overdressed for the interview, but I got some jeans and a T-shirt, and I know the guy, and if you want to go over there, and I looked at him, and I says, straighten my tie, I said, no, you don't understand, I'm a stockbroker. And they said, I thought you were a new guy, right? So I remember reaching in my pocket, and I had 7 cents on me, and I reconsidered my friend's business opportunity. And we went down to the machine shop. Now, I told you that my family was in a construction business and everything else, but by the time I was done with that line of work, the only thing they'd let me do is carry sheetrock. You know, their insurance premiums went up with me on the job site. I had a propensity for dropping tools off of scaffolding, which isn't too conducive to the health of the other workers. And so, or a beer, one or the other. And so they asked me in the interview, are you familiar with, you know, a machine shop? And my dad had a fabricating business, and I don't think I was allowed on the property. And they said, and of course I said, oh yeah, who doesn't know how to bend sheet metal or use a drill press or anything else? And off I go in there, and if you ever saw Tommy Boy, that was me. And I was in there, and I'm sure their insurance premiums went up too. But you know something? I think the guy that ran the place was in a program, and I had that job, and the guy who brought me there said, I got a storage bay across from the 101, and it's got a couch, and there's a key for the bathroom and stuff, and it's $123 a month, and you can stay there. It's got 2 weeks on it, and in your next 2 weeks, you give me $123. Here's the key. You can stay there as long as you want. So that's what I did. I stayed in there, and those accommodations weren't quite up to Westchester standards. But you know something? I love that place, and I get a little emotional thinking about it. Anytime it rained, I was always grateful that place was there. And I went to AA meetings, and I went to three a day, and I worked, and I went to that machine shop. And I remember I was going into a meeting one time on a Saturday, I looked in a mirror, and I saw a guy looking back, and he was happy, you know? And I thought I was either going nuts or I was getting better. I hadn't drank in 6 months. And so things took off just like they would for any one of us with 6 months, 8 months. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a young kid. And so my life started to come back to me. And, I gained a lot of rewards from staying sober and in the program. I was very active in AA for many years. I went to Lake Bird a couple years later. I met Aid and the rest of them, and I was off to the races. And then you hear in AA, don't ever let AA, what you get in AA, take you away from AA. And that's what happened to me. I was 5 years sober, and I got married and started a family, and started slacking off on meetings. Started slacking off on meetings, and also got really involved with, you know, working. And the seventh year, I probably only went to my home group, and shortly thereafter, I was entertaining some clients, and they came down, and they were late coming in, and the next thing you know, I'm sitting at a bar at the hotel, and they asked me, you know, what are you drinking? And I said, you know, I'll grab one of those Sam Adams, like I'm grabbing a drink of water. And I had that, and I bet I had 15 of them, because I drank a lot, and that's how I drank. And I got in my car, I drove home, and there wasn't enough booze to drink. You know what I mean? I couldn't get drunk. And my wife at the time met me with my six-month-old son, and my dad had just passed away from alcoholism, liver cancer. He had cirrhosis, and it turned into liver cancer. He died. And she said, you know, you want to end up like your dad, you know? And so I came back. I picked up a white chip the next day, and I stayed in the program and stayed clean for 4 more years. And then in that 4 years, I ended up getting divorced. And it was the 90s, and, you know, the dot-com boom was coming. And I got involved in the technology business. And, you know, my career really started to take off and, you know, did quite well and completely got wrapped up in business, got away from the program, and went out and drank. And this time I stayed out for 5 years. What I was doing is I flew from Florida every other week to New York for 7 years. And I had an apartment up there, and I would drink up there, and then I'd come home, and I'd be a good dad and everything else when I was in town. And I kind of had that existence, and it worked for a while. You know, I never touched any other substance. I just, you know, drank, but I'm an alcoholic. And we all know that alcoholics who drink don't do well. And certainly that was the case for me. And I remember I was doing some crazy things. You know, I'd take clients out for dinner, and then they would go home on Metro North, Long Island Railroad, Jersey Transit, and I would wander down towards a Staten Island ferry, and I would jump or drink beer all night long and ride the ferry. And, you know, I have no idea why I did that, but I found myself doing that from time to time, and I would go from Midtown through Alphabet City, and that's before it went co-op or whatever it is now, you know. And it was kind of a rough neighborhood, and a guy jumped out one night, and he had a knife, and he said, you know, your money or your life or something. And I was like, whoa, man, you know, take it easy. I said, you smoke pot? He goes, yeah. I go, I got some weed from Florida. He goes, well, I got some relatives in Florida. So now the guy was going to kill me. He's my best friend now, you know? So I'm hanging out with my newfound friend, and we're smoking some weed. And then I say, come on with me. We're going to Staten Island Ferry, right? So now I'm buying this guy drinks, right, this sociopath. And so at the end, he wants to know my name. We got to do this again sometime, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I think I gave him my ex-wife's husband's phone number or something. But I did find that unusual, okay? The next day, I found that slightly unusual, right? And so it got my attention. And then it wasn't too far after that that I woke up again. And at this time, I was in St. Luke's Hospital in New York, and I was covered in blood. My shirt had blood and everything else. And I was a little scared, you know, got my attention. And I looked down at the gurney and at my wrist, like any good alcoholic, to see if I was handcuffed to the gurney. And I wasn't, so that's a good sign right away, okay? So I said, okay, then I guess I'm not in that much trouble. So I, because I have a business degree, that and I'm an alcoholic, that means I'm qualified to make medical decisions. So I decided to check myself out of the hospital, and I didn't really do any paperwork. I think I got up, grabbed my shirt, and jumped on the elevator, went outside, and whistled for a cab. The cab came, brought me to the ferry that went to Jersey. I went back to New Jersey to that apartment, and I got up the next day. It's a miracle I didn't die. I mean, obviously I had a concussion. I had cracked my head real good, and I took a shower, you know, and it looked out of, you know, and it looked like a scene out of Psycho. You know what I mean, in there, and again, that you know, piqued my curiosity, and so I cleaned up and I went back into the city. Again, I would never make an appointment with a customer before 2 p.m. in the afternoon. I mean, that's definitely not a good idea for a guy like me. So I got in and I saw these people and I made my presentation. I was in like the Citicorp building. I remember like it was yesterday. And did a good job and everything else. And they said, Matt, we're going to make a decision. We got a few things to, you know, to discuss. You mind waiting in the lobby? And I went outside. I looked at the lobby, and I looked out. It was a beautiful day in New York. I looked down, and I said, I wonder if those people in there had the night like I had the night before. And my answer was probably not, you know. And I said, you got to do something about this drinking, you know, and you got to do something pretty soon. So I decided to give this thing another shot. And I knew I was in big trouble. And I remember I got down on my knees and I prayed. Now, you know, I've been talking for a half hour, I guess, or something, and I haven't mentioned God once. That's important to a guy like me and to people that practice this program, a higher power. That really wasn't my thing. And I prayed, though, for the first time in a long time for help. And I'm telling you, something happened. And I went back home, and I went back to AA, and I tried to get sober. And I'll tell you, it was tough. It was tough. I picked up 22 white chips in 2 years. And quite frankly, I stopped counting at 22. It's probably 26. So I really thought I was unconstitutionally incapable of being honest with myself, which wouldn't have surprised me. However, there was one thing that I couldn't deny, and that was that I'd been sent to AA at, you know, in 1979. I knew about AA. I knew I was an alcoholic. However, I knew that you needed a higher power and you needed to have a spiritual experience, and I didn't have either one of those things. And, you know, I'm Italian and Irish, so you know I'm not, you know, a Southern Baptist, you know. So I come from those guys, right? So I not only did I not want to be spiritual, I didn't even want to know, let God know where I was, okay, because I was in big trouble. And I remember when, you know, I remember back in the day, they said, if you even think it's a sin, you're in big trouble. So I was in big trouble. So I didn't see why we need to bring him into the discussion. So, but I was desperate. So, and I started to listen. And, you know, I had the gift of desperation, quite frankly. And then I started to hear things that I never heard before. And I started to do things that I never did before. And so what I did is I came back to the program and decided that, you know, I was going to do whatever it took to get sober. I stuck around, and I guess I tried to work a decent program, but I still really wouldn't pray, and I wouldn't do the God thing. And I came home one day, and it wasn't anything unusual. And Saturday afternoon, I talked to my ex-wife, and I had a little bit of an argument, and I went out, and at the time I lived in Boca Raton, Florida. I lived there for a while, and I went to a restaurant, and they were having a wine tasting. So I went there, and they said, you know, we were having a wine tasting. You know, you want this? And I'd gone there. I said, yeah, I'll taste a little wine. So I taste a little. They come back. They say, you want a glass? Yeah, sure, why not? So I grabbed a glass. About 4 wine bottles later, apparently I found a new love interest, okay? And so I bought a case of wine from this vendor, brought it back to my house. I guess she had other things in mind other than drinking a case of wine, okay? So she left, and I sat around, and then I thought it'd be a good idea to go out and grab a bite to eat. So I went out at 3 a.m. in the morning and was on my way to a diner and got pulled over by Boca Raton's finest. Apparently, my tag light was out, okay? Thank God for that tag light, let me tell you. So I got arrested for DUI. At this point in my life, I'm a 46-year-old professional. I have a kid that's, you know, in junior high. I got a lot of bills to pay, and this is what happens to me. So got that DUI. And that really got my attention. Now, I knew that the guys in my family died from alcoholism. I knew that they didn't have nearly the opportunity or the chance or the information about recovery that I was exposed to. And yet, I found myself in this situation. So I came back, and I basically just surrendered to AA. I surrendered to AA. With all my heart, out of pure desperation, because I didn't want to lose what I had. I had a lot to lose. And I started working the program. I got a higher power. I borrowed a friend of mine's. He told me I could borrow his higher power, and we were going to do that. And let me tell you, that started a journey for me. There's a guy in the program, I forget who it is, but he's got this tape, and he talks about a new pair of glasses. It might be Clancy, somebody like that. And that made sense to me, you know, because once I had this spiritual contact and I started to ask God to keep me away from a drink one day at a time, life, or my perception of life, changed dramatically. You know, and it was really like I looked at the world with a new pair of glasses. And it started to work for me. And, I mean, they talk about a mustard seed of faith. And that's really what it took. I just needed to be open-minded is really what it came down to. And I remember thinking to myself, you're contemplating the existence of God, and you couldn't find your ass with both hands in a compass. You see what I mean? So who are you to ask these questions, right? You know, why don't you just leave your mind open to the idea? And that's all it took for me. And my program and my sobriety and everything else just opened right up, you know? And it's remarkable. It really is. And I kept praying and, you know, being humble and did a lot of listening. At a lot of meetings, I still do a lot of listening at meetings, and my life changed. My life changed dramatically. I the quality of my sobriety, there's no comparison, you know. And to think in retrospect for me, that I could try to work this program without the spiritual side of AA. I never really had a chance. So I remember thinking to myself, because I felt bad about, you know, relapsing and struggling with AA. And when I got honest with myself, I realized, you know, without having a spiritual side of recovery, you know, for me anyway, I don't know about anybody else, but just for me, you know, I was white-knuckling it through everything, you know? And I got back into the steps, you know, and I really, really worked the steps. I always thought, you know, I'm not a bad guy. I just drink too much, you know? And I found out that I had a lot more problems other than booze, you know? And a lot of that behavior was self-centered behavior. And so I was willing to take a look at that. And I was willing to put it down on paper. I was willing to concede that up to this point in my life, perhaps I wasn't too good at directing my will or my life. And you know, again, things changed in my life. And once I got in and, you know, shared those that information with another guy and then started to work on my defects of character, that was real fun. You know, I remember I got a God box, and it's kind of cool, and I still tell my sponsees, you know, get the God box, and you just put the seven deadly sins in the box and on pieces of paper, and every day you open up, you pick out a piece of paper, and I think I picked out humility like 7 days in a row. So that kind of tells you, you know, maybe you got to start working on humility or something, you know. But I was working to the best of my ability. I really believed that I was trying the best I could to work on myself and to change. And, you know, I went back to people. You know, I made a list of people that I'd harmed, and I after that I went back to these people, and I made amends, you know. And I remember going back to my mom, and I said, you know, Ma, I'm sorry, you know. And she was the happiest person you ever met. She knew I changed, and she said, and I said, you know, I put you through a lot and this and that. She said, you know, the only thing that really bothered me was the 4 a.m. phone calls. Because, you know, when a phone rings at 4 a.m., it's never good information. And she said that the walk between her bedroom to the phone was the longest walk she ever take to get these 4 a.m. calls. She always thought that somebody was going to tell her I was dead when she picked up the... And I'm a parent, so I could appreciate that. So I never realized, you know, I always thought I never hurt anybody, you know. Poor me and this and that. And I realized that, you know, that's what I did while I was out there. And I did a lot of other things, too. But, you know, once I got that off my chest, I was kind of able to walk a free man, you know. And then, you know, today I do a 10th step, you know. I take a daily, you know, continue to take a personal inventory. And I know that I always try to keep my side of the street clean today. And it feels good. You know, it feels good to do the right thing. I was always a dicey guy, you know, my whole life. I was always dicey, right? In fact, if you ask, hey, what's Matt? They'd say he's pretty dicey, you know? And so I didn't understand, you know, this concept for a long time. But I did understand what made me feel good. And when I started to feel good about working the program, that's when I started to actually practice the principles, and when I got the rewards from it, you know, and so I do that to kind of keep my side of the street clean, and then I started praying early on in recovery, when I got sober, out of desperation and because I was told to do it. And I prayed for 5 minutes a morning. God, please keep me away from a drink of alcohol. You know, my name's Matt. I'm an alcoholic. Good morning. Bop, bop, bop. See you later. So what happened is then it started to get a little longer. Then it was suggested, hey, maybe you want to look at this prayer. This makes sense. Hey, I saw this reading. This looks interesting. There's something about acceptance. I like that. The long serenity prayer looks kind of cool, and this and that. And the next thing you know, my routine's 25 minutes long in the morning. Now, I'm here to tell you, I'm just, you know, I'm not that guy. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, I'm standing up here to tell you that if you're new or you got struggle with something, I'm like you, man. I'm not that guy. And I am today, though. I am today. And if I don't do that routine, my day's shot, you know? I mean, I got to do that. That's something. And I got this, like, friendship with God. And it's really cool, you know? And so part of my deal is, the primary purpose. You know, I used to have a tendency to get off track occasionally. And from a priority perspective, you know? And chasing some money, stuff like that, and some other things. And I know what my primary purpose today is. And I love my primary purpose. To stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And I try to do that. I owe that to you and my higher power. And I don't lose focus of that, you know? And when something comes up, I always ask myself, how important is it? And when in doubt, do nothing. That's some of the best advice I've ever gotten, you know? And to be honest with you, when I ask myself, how important is it? You know, it's usually not that important. And when that when in doubt, do nothing thing, man, you know, that's saved me from a lot of kind of bad situations. So that's kind of the way I do things. I'm really glad to be here tonight. I was in Lake Bird back in the day, and I've been up here before, but this place is real special, you know, and there's a vibe here, you know, and it's kind of somebody told me it's like the connection of the spirits or something, you know, people's, it's something that is magical, you know, it's the only thing I can say, you know, and you hear it from everybody, and for me to be able to come up here and, you know, share my experience, strength, and hope with you has been an honor, and, you know, I just want to thank you for your kind attention. Thanks.